think we should get going.
Okay, yeah, let's go.
It's fine.
You're not allowed to leave early.
We can't talk to each other.
I'm going to thank you for the moment for coming up next to me. Okay, I'm Hugo Benita Silva. I'm here at SUNY Stony Brook in the economics department. I'm actually a colleague of Michael's work. My expertise is not really in working class studies, but I'm very interested. So I'm happy to chair this session of country studies followed. So we have three presenters, three papers I've already presented. We're going to start with Samir Moiraz from BMT University in Istanbul, okay, who's a case of finishing your PhD in political science. He's going to talk about working class reactions against neoliberalism and analysis of the privatization process in Turkey after the 1980s. We have supposedly an hour and a half. I think maybe we should do maybe 25 minutes.
Let's see, okay, as well.
I mean, we'll see how it goes. So
okay.
Hopefully there's some questions.
That's
excellent.
Okay, yes. Hello again. I'm a PhD student in political science in Istanbul University. I am trying to combine in my study Marxist theories of class and nationalism and nation creation. And I planned to start this study 5 years ago. And I just try to map working class consciousness and mentality with a specific example of political economy. And my case, I choose the privatization case in Turkey as an example of how structural processes or structural dynamics in the global economy are experienced by workers in a subjective case, in a specific case. So. In this journey, in this presentation, I want to just start the brief definition of privatization and rhetoric of privatization or ideology of privatization in Turkey first. We can define privatization as a complex phenomenon in which a wide range of formula public goods and services are transformed into commodities available on the market. And privatization was also taking place through the use of private contractors for the purchase, sale, delivery of particular goods and services that have previously been provided by the state. And in this rhetoric of ideology of privatizations, which have been dominant and hegemonic in Turkish case, as like in many countries, the debt problem, fiscal crisis problem, the need for the discipline of the market discourse, and the discourse of public budgets are cast as undisciplined, unruly, and out of control. And the point is that maybe I should say it later, but it is important to say it now. This rhetoric and ideology to justify privatization in Turkey did not work. For example, did this solve the debt problem in Turkey? No. Did this solve the fiscal crisis problem in Turkey? No. Did it discipline the market mechanisms, free market mechanisms? No. Or public budgets are well organized, ruling, and in control? No. So these discourses, these rhetoric are used to justify privatization and to manipulate public opinion in Turkey. And actually it worked. You can say that in the final solution. How it worked, if you ask this question, especially the language of ownership and entrepreneurialism have been hegemonic in the society. And a culture of competition and internalization of neoliberal values could be done in this process with these discourses and with the public effect. If you go to, give a brief history of privatization in Turkey, it has started in 1984, just after the military government gave the power to political elite in 1993. The first attempt was seen in 1984, just like the neoliberal regimes and arguments introduced by Margaret Thatcher and Reagan. And in Turkey, it started after 1980s as well. And main wave of privatization were suggested under the IMF, World Bank, World Trade Organization, and OECD guidance. And the neoconservative, I will explain about the government, current government in Turkey, which came power in 2002. The neoconservative Justice and Development Party government executed these privatizations in a rapid manner because they were the heavy majority in the parliament, so it was so easy for them to execute this privatization process. So the master plan for this privatization in 8 years was that, including that, the major public banks would be merged and privatized in 3 years. This was done. State subsidies to farming would be stopped. This was done too, especially due to pressures from the European Union accession process of Turkey. And public expenditure would be cut by 9%. This was done too, especially in education, health, in many areas of social services, public expenditures were cut. Public sector salaries would be frozen. This was achieved. And the inflation control program also justified the frozening of public salaries. And the most important one for in this master plan introduced in 2002 was that public-owned or state-owned telecommunications, electricity, airlines, petroleum, steel, tobacco and spirits, sugar, natural gas, electricity distribution industries would be privatized and open to global markets. And we can say that in these 8 years, 90% of most important state economic enterprises were privatized by this conservative or neoconservative neoliberal government of Justice and Development Party. In my study, I focused on five major state economic enterprises in Turkey. The first one is TEKA in paper production, which was one of the biggest paper production factory in Europe as well, not only in Turkey, but it was closed down. The other one is the Erdemir iron steel factory, which is very well known in Europe in its production capacity. The second one is in telecommunications with Türk Telekom. The third one is Telekom. The fourth one is Pepki and Tüpraş, which are the one of the biggest oil refinery and production plants in the Europe. And the last one is tobacco and agrochemicals production, TEKA. And first, they start with the legal framework, to change the legal framework. Because between 1984 and 1996, all attempts for privatization were cancelled by the Constitutional Court. Because the Constitutional Court announced that it violates national interests. These privatizations are against national interests. So they changed the legal framework, especially European Union accession process helped this reformulation of the legal framework. So as you see, law on public administration, public procurement, law on municipalities and local governments, law on social security systems, law on regional development agencies. So in many areas, in everything, administrative and economic areas, these legal frameworks were extended. And during this process, we witnessed that in the capitalist side, in the capitalist class fractions, we witnessed that large-scale internationalized companies in Turkey, such as Koç, Sabancı, and Oyak Group, supported these privatizations. But the problem was that, for them, they say that we are nationalist companies and we should win the tenders of these privatized state economic enterprises. So they try to take the benefit of being domestic or being national. And they promise that they won't sell their shares to international foreign companies. So we saw the deal strategy, or we can call it opportunism of capitalists in Turkey. They use this label of being national in this privatization process. They put pressure to government for these privatizations, but they also wanted these enterprises should be sold to national companies. So any huge Nationalist campaign has started during these privatizations, and public opinion, public debates were manipulated by this contradiction, rather than the contradiction of labor and capital, but the contradiction between foreign enemies, foreign capital as enemies, and national capital as our friends, with respect to national interests. So, if you look at the small and mid-scale companies, another fraction of capitals in Turkey, they also supported these privatizations, and they also demanded tax compensations, and they also demanded to change the rules in privatization, because scale, economies of scale matter in this privatization. So there was no chance for these small and mid-scale companies to win the tender or to win the procurement process because of their scale. So they also used national interest slogan or national interest discourse during these privatizations. But on the other side, they also trying to search for routes to international markets, and they try to merge with multinational companies as well. In my field research, I just want to summarize my brief result in my research, but before that, I want to talk about the methodology. I am working on this privatization case for 5 years. I started the theoretical and literature survey issues, and I analyzed published and non-published official documents, reports, brochures, handouts. I tried to check everything. And in the field research, I first conduct a questionnaire with workers who are subject to privatization process in these factories. The number is 500. I also, because I didn't like the quantitative analysis research is enough to understand working class reality. You can't adjust as just give questions to workers, and you know, it is not reliable to a great extent for me. So I also conduct focus group interviews, 8 or 10 workers in a, it was sometimes 20 or 30, they like to contribute to discussion in time. I also conduct focus group interviews with workers. I also conduct in-depth interviews with labor union professionals and intellectuals or leftists who became part of this discussion, mostly suggesting the national interest slogan and discourse. But it's a contradictory situation because being leftist requires some internationalism as well. So I also tried to discuss and conduct interviews with these leftist socialist intellectuals as well. And the first thing I saw during my interviews and focus group discussion, I saw that this etatism or state-centrism of labor unions was so obvious, was so visible. And the language of nationalism was so dominant in the discussions. Especially they focused on anti-imperialism, national developmentalism, but they never focused or discussed anti-capitalist and class-based politics. The most discussion was based on the there are foreign enemies, foreign capital, trying to invade Turkey, and we should do something for our national interests alone. And they also say that, during these interviews and studies, they also say privatizations are attacks against national independence, sovereign territory. For example, privatizations are rarely defined as an attack to working class in different terms. So, national interest as well. For example, one of them talked about the major aim of privatization in Turkey is to dissolve Turkey, to bring Serbs instead of Lausanne. These are the agreements signed after the First World War against Turkey. So, it was defined as a national independence war. And they also discussed that this, we should discuss this in also dependence theory in a theoretical discussion. They also discussed that in a less developed country like Turkey, all classes should pursue nationalism and act in accordance with national interests, rather than class conflict, which is peculiar to advanced capitalist countries. So, in their perceptions, in their discussions, both labor unions and workers, they say that class conflict or class struggle is not accordance with our national interests, so we should give the priority to our national interest discourse and nationalism as well. One of the labor unions leaders said that in these interviews, they said that they saw planet stations as a possible meteor that would not reach the planet for thousands of years. So they were not prepared when planet stations stopped. So they were unprepared, but they were shocked how could this happen after 30 years of traditional state economic enterprises. They were shocked how can state do that again, because they were state-centric, labor unions, they were supporting state, national interest, nationalism, so they were shocked, they were surprised, so it seems that they were unprepared to this massive attack of privatizations in Turkey. So the reactions are mostly based on nationalist discourse rather than class or anti-capitalist content. And for example, one of the largest companies in Turkey, Oya, during this privatization process for Erdemir, steel factory in Turkey, steel and iron factory in Turkey, they say that during these discussions, they try to manipulate public opinion based on the nationalist ideology or nationalist discourse. They say that Oya is a guarantee for the Turkish nation. We cannot let foreign ownership in Erdemir, which they become a big steel factory again, I think, as well as Türk Telekom in telecommunications and Tüpraş in petroleum or oil refinery production. So they say that these are national strategic corporations. So they support, they try to manipulate public opinion in these nationalist slogans. But it is strange that after OYAK Group and national enterprise or capitalist group in Turkey won the tender of privatization of Erdemir, they sold their shares to French Arcelor company in just 2 months, just after the privatization. So many people supporting these nationalist arguments rather than focusing on the class content of privatizations or class struggle dynamics of privatizations were surprised because they felt betrayed. They were shocked again. So, for example, they say, when OYAK involved in the privatization tenders, we got happy, they say. This is a labor union leader. They say that OYAK is a national company seeking national interest. So, when Koç won the Tüpraş tender, another big state enterprise, the wise people of this country felt relieved. But all the shares, actually most shares of this company were sold to international companies in a short time. So, after the sale of OYAK to OYAK's shares in the stock market to Arcelor, the leader of Hakiş, which is a conservative, said, in Turkey there is something strange. There are three main labor union confederations. One of them is Nationalist Workers Confederation of Labor Unions, and the other one is Revolutionary Workers Labor Union, and the other one is Conservative Workers Labor Union. So the political divisions are so important to understand the case in Turkey, the conditions of working class in Turkey. So they say that OYAK and Arcelor, the marriage between OYAK and Arcelor is natural because it's a must to follow technological innovations and conquer new markets. We have witnessed that such romantic and nationalist reactions they support before the tender or debate, these romantic and nationalist reactions do not accord with economic rationality. So I can understand labor unions, he says, because they support these arguments, but he said that they don't understand domestic business. So I also tried to analyze the. How many minutes do I have?
10 minutes.
Okay. If you look at the slogans during the privatization process, you can see this nationalism based or national interest, independency slogans in the protests as well. You can see some slogans from the protests. So, as I said previously earlier, the main contradiction in workers' perception and mentality, I don't want to criticize because it is normal for me. I can understand this contradiction. The main contradiction is there are foreign capitals planning to invade Turkey. They try to end all sovereignty, and we should support national companies. So we can see this phenomenon, this reality in the astronomers as well. So they also, we also should talk about, for example, I try to check whether local struggles are possible during privatizations. Because, as you know, these companies are so important in this local society or local groups or in these towns, in these cities. I just try to understand that these people supported working class movement or workers' struggle during privatizations. But because of this neoliberal hegemony and dominant ideology and discourse of these state economic enterprises are ineffective and unproductive and non-profitable. So all people think in this way. So they, when I went to the local communities and I talked to people, they said that they support privatizations and they don't support workers. Because they are hoping as well, one more issue, they also hope their kids, their children will find a job in this privatized company rather than workers who already work there. We also see some attempts for workers' ownership. For example, some labor unions suggested workers should get the tender of privatization, should own the factories. This happened in one steel factory in Karabük, but it didn't work because in a year, we should question about the workers' ownership of factories or workers to socialize the ownership issue. Because in a year, all workers were forced to sell their shares in the stock market to larger companies. So it didn't work. So I understood that during my project and field research, national interest and objective conditions of internationalization of capital and dominant discourse of national competitiveness really bring obstacles to the prospects for international labor solidarity. Because I also checked these workers in Turkey during privatizations get support from labor unions in Europe. But the strange thing is that nobody discussed privatizations. They just try to protect workers' rights, social rights, compensation rights, or retirement rights. So material, real benefits they discuss. They don't discuss if it is national or foreign. So they don't get support from the European labor unions. They don't have such a political agenda. So it was much more difficult to develop working class solidarity on the international level. During the interviews, I also tried to understand the political preferences maybe influential in their reactions as well. So, one of the most important things I saw, most strange thing I saw, they are so pessimistic about the EP's future. 90% of these workers, I just try to summarize, I don't want to show this SPSS data, but 90%, I don't like this data, it was so suffering for me. But I just summarize main results. 90% of these workers are really pessimist about their own future and their kids' future. But when you ask the question, are you happy now? They say yes. When I try to understand the reason for this, in Turkey, religion really plays an important role in shaping working class mentality and consciousness. For example, when I discuss the working conditions with workers, they say that we are thankful to God, we are okay. Because in Turkey, it is always manipulated in 5 minutes. In the media, Chinese workers are in terrible conditions. So it is always manipulated in public opinion. Your conditions are good. Your conditions are better. You should be okay. You shouldn't resist. So many people told me that we are okay. Thanks to God. Thanks to these religious guys in the government, we are better than Chinese workers. So this is a really important issue to understand the possibilities of international labor movement. And the most important problems they taught me in the working line is lack of job security, working conditions, and retirement age. And 60% of these workers think that unions should not engage with politics in any form. It is a systematic attempt in the establishment of working labor unions in Turkey. It is stated in the law. Labor unions cannot engage in politics. If they do, they violate the national interest. So is the problem for many labor unions. The most important division in the workplace, I asked this question, is between contracted and subcontracted workers. They consider themselves as enemies because these subcontracted workers are accepting so low wages and get a job in the factory, so these contracted workers who work there for 20 years are fired. This was another contradiction I observed during this study. And they say that, I just try to understand how they see the role of the state and national enterprise in the economy. And 72% of the workers think that state and national enterprises must be dominant in economic life. And there was a high ratio in male attitudes against privatization, but they did not tell me, they did not discuss, we are against privatization because it is against working class interests, it is against our social rights, or material rights, or wages. They did not discuss the only arguments they suggested, national interest, independence, and sovereignty. This shows that nationalism, actually opportunist, use of nationalist discourse in Turkey has been influential in the struggle against privatization. For example, 80% of these workers consider foreign capital as a threat and enemy to national interest. 77% of the workers think that these state economic enterprises, which are unproductive and ineffective, should be privatized. But this is a public manipulation, this is an ideology as well, because these state economic enterprises were purposefully being unproductive. For example, state did not invent for technology, for some innovations to these factories. So it was a political decision, but they didn't discuss this issue. One of these strange results is that 77% of these workers think that national interests are prior to their class interests. Actually, this tells the formation of working class from the early Republican period and how dominant etatist or state-centric approach of labor unions have been influential in workers as well. So, for example, they don't criticize capitalist fractions attempts in Turkey, national capitalists or domestic capital groups in Turkey. They criticize these privatizations originate from foreign dynamics, foreign enemies, and foreign pressures. Do I have 2 minutes? 1 minute. Okay, maybe I will go on in the questions for some points in the discussion. I have some food for thought. Another issue that is the general issue which is discussed in the United States as well, the question of immigrant workers, especially in Turkey, Kurdish workers coming from the east region of Turkey to big cities to find a job. We see a tension, a class based on ethnicity. So this immigration also caused similar problems we can see in different country contexts. When I asked the most important divisions, lastly, for example, I suppose I wait for answer in this way between worker and employer, or capital and labor, or based on worker real interests. They say that the most important divisions in Turkey, the first two, is that between Turkish and Kurdish, and secular and religious. These two identity issues dominate public opinion and politics in Turkey, so it is very difficult to find the job security issues, working class conditions, or how big will we create new jobs for these undeserved, for this deserved arm of labor in Turkey. The most important political debates are based on this Kurdish issue and secularism and religious conservatism discussions in Turkey. So, during my study, the first lesson I learned, I will just summarize it in a minute. It is very difficult to understand the reactions, the perceptions, the mentality, the discussions, and how they approach these debates If you externalize yourself to class or workers, so during my research, I understood that if people study working classes, their problems, their perceptions, their different dynamics, if you study, we should do that through learning and experiencing with working classes, rather than taking a questionnaire and asking many of those questions, are you supporting socialism or liberalism? Are you defining yourself as a working class member or what else? So these questions, I saw, this is meaningful, so we also need qualitative analysts and researchers, and also we should be participatory. We should spend time to understand the real world. And this is also important to build a language to understand their perceptions and mentality as well. So, last sentence in this presentation, I also try to observe different studies on class phenomenon. I also try to listen to many presentations here. One of the most important problems is that orthodoxy and it is whitenessy. In this research or study attempts of working classes, most researchers try to look for a class they want to see. Actually, the reality is very different. And there is the diversity of different dimensions to understand working class reality. Their subjectivities, their identities, cultural and political dimensions, and their daily life practices, everyday experiences are so important to understand how we can study working class phenomenon and how can we contribute to this struggle, how can we develop international solidarity of working class. Thank you so much.
Some questions or something? So, my second presenter is Fumi Adewunmi from Osun State University in Nigeria. He's the head of the Department of Economics and Management Science. He's going to tell us about the trade unions in the global economy, the challenge of social movement unions.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, as indicated by the chair, I'm looking at trade unions and global economy, the challenge of social movements we are in. What we're trying to do is to look at the dynamics of what is called the global economy. How do they affect trade unions or workers and their perception of trade unions? And how should the trade unions engage the developments that you uphold in? Of course, gleefully, people talk about globalization, global economy, they appear sweet ways, but they are very bitter to those who are the victims of the system. The global economic meltdown that occurred in the last 2-3 years, 2007-2008, with the sort of the pandemic crisis in Latin America here, for me, just represents another stage in the periodic crisis of the capitalist system. And contrary to the impression given by those who have been for the system, that is nothing new, and it's not a short-term problem. Like he mentioned this in presentation, from about the mid-1980s, with Thatcher as British Prime Minister and Reagan as President here, what we now call neoliberalism took over. And that process was helped by the dismemberment of the Soviet Union. And effectively what emerged is what I refer to as a unipolar economic order, with the USA acting as the policeman of the entire world. And unfortunately, unlike what happened in the era of the Cold War, there is actually no counter-block to contest issues with the hegemony of the USA. Of course, lately, France was trying, and then maybe Germany to a certain extent. Now, we are then saying that it is important for workers and health organizations to have a proper understanding of what is telling us in the case. Because if you don't have a proper understanding of what the problems are, you are not likely to provide the right solutions. Of course, our position is that the trade unions on their own cannot successfully tackle the capitalist system. They need to look for allies within the polity who are equally disadvantaged in the scheme of things and present a common front to address the problems. I don't want to bore us with the details of the economic crisis. I, at a minor level, maybe I can send a joint copies to members of this panel, for those who are in this session. Well, I use Nigeria as a metaphor, really. What is unfolding in Nigeria is not fundamentally different from what is happening in Turkey, even the USA, of course. Maybe different social safety nets are available in different countries, and that is a little different. The problem of Nigeria, just like many developing countries, lies in its over dependency on the metropolitan economies. For instance, in the last decade or so, the IMF, the World Bank have cajoled developing countries to go for what they call FDI, foreign direct investment. And that has done a lot of damage to those developing countries. First, what is FDI? Statistics from the World Bank and the IMF have confirmed that less than 5%, that is 3.7%, of the total FDI went into the developing countries. Even when you liberalize conditions to attract foreign investors, such do not make a lot of difference. Now, in this, the global economic meltdown affected countries like Nigeria in a more devastating form because companies, foreign investors invested substantially in the Nigerian Stock Exchange. And once there was a problem in the other countries, they started withdrawing their investment. I don't know whether how you appreciate this. The Nigerian Stock Exchange lost about $4 billion arising from massive withdrawal, and that had a trickle down effect. And up to now, most of the Nigerian economy is still suffering from that. So I then want to say that contrary to what the apologies and spin doctors of capitalism want us to believe, what is staring us in the face is a depressed economy and not mere recession, which is defined as a drop in the gross domestic product in at least 2 successive quarters. And this is reflective of the contradictions inherent in the capitalist mode of production, which is driven by what somebody has described as the boundless greed of international finance and the compound interest in satellite for maximum profits. It doesn't matter whether the rest of us go into extinction, as long as these people make their profits, all is well and good. Essentially, the fundamental tradition of capitalist production is based on social production, which is privately appropriated. That is the fundamental tradition of the capitalist mode of production. Social production that is privately appropriated. Put another way, only a few people appropriate the gains of the involvement of all of us in the production process. This contradiction between the secular forces and capitalist production relations finds birth in crises, which occur periodically in a long-governed way. The bourgeoisie can overcome them by preparing the way for new and deeper and more competitive crises. And the fact that the present crisis has been acknowledged as being more grievous than that of 1930, is a confirmation of this. And again, the fact that successive measures that have been undertaken by governments in Nigeria elsewhere are afraid to address or to solve the problem is an indication that there is something much more fundamental that they make us to believe. And unfortunately for most of us, workers, middle class elements, we refuse, we fail to come to terms with this reality because of our own illusions. Now, in what ways have Nigerian workers been affected by neoliberalism? Again, like I said earlier, what is true of Nigerian workers or Nigerian situation is largely true of those developing countries, because people are not for themselves. I identified 8 different ways by which workers and the organizations are affected. First, Nigeria, like many countries, was forced to engage or embark on what was called public service reforms. That is where you talk of privatization, cutting public expenditure, and at the end of the day, thousands of jobs were lost. And I keep telling my friends in human resource management that when employers talk of right-sizing, downsizing, they can't tell you what constitutes the right size. It is their drive for profitability that determines what at any given point constitutes the right size. The second way by which workers and workers are affected is through the massive devaluation of national currencies. When the national currency has a low value, it pushes up the cost of imported components of production inputs. And the inability of organizations to meet this normally results in low capacity utilization. And if companies are operating far below their stock capacity, of course, there is a limit to the level of employment that can be generated. So, in the case of Nigeria, in the last 20 years, really, the average capacity utilization has been below 40%. Of course, in one or two industries, we have 50 something, but both of them below 20 already. And that's why you have redundancy. You shut that temporarily, hoping to recover workers when things get better. The third one is the liberalization of finance and trade. And this includes high interest rates. Trade liberalization involves, as you all know, the insistence of the developed countries, really, that developing countries should not protect their own domestic industries. And unfortunately, many of these countries fall for that. There is no country, maybe the exception is a China that has refused to succumb to the pressure of the US or the West about protectionism. If industries are just developing countries, it would be unfair to say that they should not be protected because they cannot stand competition from their non-capitalist countries who enjoy superior technology and the economy of scale as it were. But again, most developing countries fall prey to that. And at the end of the day, domestic production or the goods that are produced locally cannot compete in terms of quality with those that are imported. And we cannot force consumers, if I can afford it, I have a better quality product from outside and a locally made one, I will go for the better quality stuff. It's as simple as that. In fact, in Nigeria, the textile industry has virtually collapsed. In the 70s and early 80s, Nigerian textile products were competing favorably with any other. In fact, there was a lot of people that what we call the Accra prints, the one you call Hollandis from there or whatever, are imported to out of Nigeria. They are repackaged and brought back. Now, the industry has virtually collapsed. In 1996 or thereabouts, there were about 100,000 workers employed in the textile industries in Nigeria. Today, there are less than 10,000. But I think it's just one or two textile companies that are operating. And stupidly, the Nigerian government has decided to pump 80 billion naira into that. That's about $500 million into that sector. It will not stop anything for them. Of course, I'm sure they are going to give money to themselves. Because even if you pump that money, if you don't control inflow of imported textile materials, you cannot stop any problem. The fifth one is the place that that's the fifth way of form in which our workers and immigrants are affected. It's what is called flexibility in standards and conditions of employment. Under the regime of globalization, foreign investors have been very frontal in insisting on labor market flexibility and exception from compliance with sustainable standards and regulations. Their argument is that the standards of because of lack of flexibility, it will affect their operations. So they are saying, we love this mayor. Of course, it is in tune with the ideology of neoliberalism. Less involvement of the state, role by the state, less market forces determine what happens within the economy. The recourse to what is called non-standard form of employment is also a fallout of this. We are talking of casual labor, we are talking of outsourcing and things like that. And at the end of the day, when what people, what employers call non-core services are outsourced, you are also reducing the comfort and the possibilities of the full employment, and you are also reducing the quality of having quality employment and the quality decent work, as you say, because those jobs that are outsourced, those who are outsourced, don't usually enjoy the same benefits like those who have normal contracts. Of course, you have the refusal of employers to allow their workers to, to belong to unions. That's against the labor of the trade union law in Nigeria. But then, in the face of mass unemployment, when you have to choose between belonging to a union and not having a job, or having a job and not having a union, and the government doesn't move off for the court, and in many cases, in a very soft manner, non-union membership is made a precondition for employment of a new hands. Of course, another issue has to do with the abuse of expatriate quota by foreign companies investing in Nigeria. I put it this way, when you are inviting foreign investors, they give you a lot of conditionalities that you are forced to accept because you want foreign investment. And I liken it to when you wetlist an aircraft. When you wetlist an aircraft, you are taking the aircraft and the entire crew. So in the same manner, this foreign investors come, okay, we must bring these engineers, technicians, and things like that. So at the end of the day, they come in without expanding the possibility of a new employment opportunities for workers, as it were. So at the end of the day, again, what you have, the situation remains as it were before. I mentioned the outsourcing and another word is before. Then people don't realize this. The use of capital intensive technology is another way of shortchanging workers. By definition, capital intensive technology relies less on human labor. So you may have a technology that is worth 15 billion US dollars that may not employ more than 20 workers. And we have quite a number of examples. There is a Nigerian Breweries is a Well, the point to note about the recourse of employers or investors to high tech is that machines do not resist capital intimidation. As such, capitalists seek to replace workers with machines. Not even because of economic advantages and the sort of information, but because workers organize to resist exploitation. Lastly, employers have adopted these days what they call the strategic human resource management approach. It is an anti-union managerial ideology or philosophy, and it's deliberately adopted to shut out workers of collective organization. So, if you relate all this to the impact on the vast majority of people, Nigerians, Turkish, the Americans, whatever, I then argue that it provides a good opportunity or a good ground to strike alliance among people that are disadvantaged. And this is where the idea of social movements, UNC, comes in. What do we mean by social movement unionism? It refers to a conscious engagement of the trade unions with broad social and political issues, as well as the leading concerns of the members in collaboration with other groups within the quality, who share the same concerns with the unions on any particular issue. So, apart from the number of economic issues which trade unions address, social movement organizing is concerned with the social dimensions of and policies created by unpopular economic and political regimes. In Nigeria, we have a rich history of the social movement unionism in the period prior to independence. In fact, the independence struggle was won largely by a coalition of forces, the trade unions, the nationalist movements, and things like that. The most recent example we always refer to is that of South Africa, where social movement unionism was a very stable tool in the, ensuring the end of the apartheid. Well, in the Fourth Republic, we came back to a civilian rule again in 1999, and since that time, a lot of collaboration has taken place between the trade unions and other society organizations. The problem is that that engagement is episodic, it's not in a sustained and coherent manner. You just address one issue today, you get some concessions, and you go back to yourself. And we are arguing that the way things are going, you need much more than such episodic reaction. There must be that ongoing engagement of trade unions with the society, other social organizations. For a number of reasons, the trade unions are very weak, numerically, their finances are poor, and there is a lack of commitment on the part of a large percentage of the trade union leadership. In fact, many of them will not want to have to do with those of us who they regard as troublemakers. And they easily cut this, we both have that commitment. So it becomes necessary, because we are arguing that the trade unions should explore that possibility. Now, if I'm arguing that the leadership is not forthcoming, then who does it? Since we also benefit, that's the other civil society organizations benefit from such a collaboration, it would be possible for some of us to also find a way of bringing the leadership of the trade unions. It's tedious, it's a little problematic, but then we don't have any option other than to do that. Of course, when I make a case for social movement unionism, I'm not oblivious of the problems that are causing such alliances. Again, the case of Africa is a good example. We were saying that yesterday, you have alliance partners, you are not even too sure of their commitment to the interests of the others. But other countries can learn from such experiences. And lastly, the involvement of global players in the domestic economy suggests that unions should also internationalize their struggles. Employers, investors, they go into mergers and to strengthen their positions. Workers and their owners cannot do less. You have international federations, national tribunal sectors, and things like that. And virtually all the tribunals in Nigeria belong to one international union or the other. And I'm saying the only justification for such involvement would be to also get those international chapters to do something in terms of a campaign or social labeling on behalf. Let me put it this way. If investors in America know that they will not find it easy to do substandard gifts to that organization, to workers in Nigeria, they will stay back in. They come back and they come to Nigeria because they know they can abuse governments. But then, if the Nigerian workers and organizations can then alert the American people that this is what your people are doing, and the man campaigning, they will not find it forced to stay back here and do the right thing, and I'm looking for sources of cheap labor and the sort of conditions. So, finally, in our conclusion, ladies and gentlemen, the crises of capitalism have been very manifest in the last 2 decades. The working class and other people who are just information are these are the sort of points that are meant for the nature of the working class, which art and the BS of design of mentors. It's a crazy character of the employee region of the economic policies. Nigerian workers and trade unions must come down with this game reality and stop appropriately. The union should realize that they are containing the power of the national finance capital that is in firm control of the unipolar world economic order. The early involvement of transnational corporations and foreign investment in the national economy means that the unions are prevented from being forced, and this underscores the need for working in collaboration with other society actors in addressing social and economic concerns. To give effect to the above, there is the need for a massive program of workers' education targeted at the rank and file members. This should be done with a view to raising workers' consciousness. They should realize their potentials as a class in itself, and more importantly, a class for itself. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. So today's last presenter is Tim Fowler from Carleton University. He's a candidate for a PhD in political science. That's a very suggestive title. If you don't know where you're going, you'll end up nowhere. Canadian Labour and Strategic Voting. So please.
I've got a lot of acronyms in my paper, which I put up there because I don't use PowerPoint, so I'm afraid of it. It occurred to me this morning when I woke up and I'm talking about the Canadian labor movement's electoral strategy, probably to a bunch of people who know absolutely nothing about election laws in Canada. So before I start talking about the labor movement, I'm going to do a very, very quick rundown of Canada's electoral system, because if I don't, what I say will make no sense to you. I'm not promising it'll make any sense afterwards, but still. So Canada's a federation. We have 10 provinces and one federal government. I'm going to start right off by saying I'm talking about English-speaking Canada, which is 9 of the 10 provinces, because as soon as you start talking about Quebec, it just really changes everything, because it's very different there. So federally, there are 308 ridings, and there are four parties that regularly contest elections, the Conservatives, the Liberals, the New Democrats, and the Greens. Three of these managed to elect members of Parliament. The Green Party has never managed to elect a single member of Parliament in Canada, yet they contest every riding in Canada. And only two parties, the Liberals and the Conservatives, have ever formed national government. So the big thing about it is it's a plurality voting system, it's not a majority voting system. So you often get ridings where the winning candidate will win somewhere between 38 to 46% of the popular vote. It is very rare that a riding and candidate will win a majority. In fact, there are some ridings with numerous small parties that contest elections in Canada where you'll find someone winning a riding with 27% of the votes or something. So what invariably happens is there will be a call at some point from someone on the left, usually the New Democrats or the Liberals, to vote strategically, to coordinate voting on a riding-by-riding level, to ensure that the Conservative candidate does not run up the middle of all the so-called progressive votes and win the riding. This never works, and which I'm going to point out is one of the problems of it. The other thing is Canadians have a very hard time in the average voter separating the provincial parties from the federal parties. Even though most of them are distinctly separate, people will hold the federal party, for example, to fault for things the provincial wings have done, when in some cases all they do is share a name and they're not at all connected other than the name. For example, the Liberal Party of British Columbia is this incredibly reactionary right-wing party, which has nothing to do with the federal Liberals, but they share the same name. So anyway, that's sort of the rundown of the background of the Canadian electoral system that hopefully will mean some of the things I'm talking about will make sense. So conventional wisdom surrounding union party relations in Canada holds that the New Democratic Party, the NDP, is the political arm of organized labor. The NDP was the successor of the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation. The CCF was Canada's first and only electorally viable socialist party, and the CCF in Saskatchewan was North America's first socialist government that was elected in the continent. The CCF had a hard time breaking out of the prairies. It never crossed the Ottawa River into being able to form government in any of the eastern provinces and saw its electoral numbers declining. So in the 1960s, talks came to revitalize the party. The CCF joined with the Canadian Labour Congress to form the NDP, the New Democratic Party. And the mandate of this party was to be the political arm of organized labor. It was supposed to have much more trade union involvement, and appeal more to the working class, and yet right out of the gates, the NDP kind of seemingly abandoned this by opening itself up as a party of farmers, labor, and liberally minded individuals. So right from the get-go, we had a labor party that had abandoned labor. The institutional links between labor and the NDP were initially quite strong, but these links have weakened over time and have been exceptionally weak in the era of neoliberalism. The electoral strategy of the Canadian labor movement has really changed quite significantly in the past decades. Some elements of the labor movement remain officially loyal to the NDP. There are three or four unions in Canada that encourage their members to vote for the party at election time, and where it is legal, donate money to the party. Many unions, for a variety of reasons I'll get into, have distanced themselves from the party. And much of the Canadian labor movement has endorsed the strategy of strategic voting, voting for the candidate which has the best chance of defeating a conservative candidate. And this is theoretically supposed to elect a parliament which is friendly to the labor movement. I have long argued, and I will argue today, that the strategy of strategic voting is misguided for two major reasons. Pragmatically, it's never worked. Labor has failed more often than it has succeeded in coordinating strategic voting. And ideologically, I argue, it makes little sense as the Liberal Party of Canada, a party for which advocates of strategic voting encourage people to vote for, has never been a friend of the labor movement. So I'm going to first provide a brief overview of Union Party relations in Canada, then I'm going to highlight a few of the successes and many of the many failures of strategic voting to sort of suss out and perhaps why they do this. So as I pointed out, the NDP was initially formed as a coalition of the Canadian Labour Congress and the CCF. The affiliation of Canadian unions to the NDP has never surpassed 15%. And so 15% was the high watermark of unions affiliating to the party. Now, that occurred in 1961 when the party was formed. Ever since 1961, union affiliation to the NDP has declined. The Canadian labor movement has never been able to motivate its members to vote for the NDP in any meaningful way. In 1962, a Gallup poll reported that voters from union homes had supported the Liberals more than they supported the NDP. And throughout the entire course of the NDP, at the federal level, unionists have consistently voted conservative and liberal more than they voted New Democrats. The New Democratic Party in 50 years has never been the number one choice of union members or union households in Canada. One of the first major challenges to the NDP labor link came in the 1970s. With the onset of neoliberalism, traditional social democratic parties became challenged worldwide. At this time, the federal Liberal government introduced wage controls in Canada, and they were not seriously opposed by the NDP. The NDP sort of bought into the rhetoric of wage controls at the federal level, arguing that yes, indeed, these were good for, you know, the Canadian working class, because it would help fight inflation, and fighting inflation is good, according to their bizarre logic. At this time, various provincial governments were NDP governments, and they started introducing back-to-work legislation, ending legal strikes, introducing wage controls and austerity measures of their own. So in the 1970s, there was considerable backlash from the trade union movement towards the NDP. Formal links between the Canadian Labour Congress and the NDP in the 1970s were described by one observer as frail at best. One of the biggest tests of the relationship in recent history came in the 1988 federal election. The 1988 election was characterized by one major issue, the proposed free trade agreement between Canada and the United States. The incumbent progressive conservatives were in favor of free trade, while the Liberals and the NDP were opposed to the deal. The labor movement urged the NDP to campaign solely against free trade and identify themselves as the clear alternative to free trade. Instead, the party didn't do this. The party campaigned on a broad platform, which included a number of other policy planks, which never became significant electoral issues in the campaign. In the end, the progressive conservatives were re-elected with a massive legislative majority, and free trade became a reality in Canada. The labor movement felt betrayed by the NDP. They said that not enough attention had been paid to the issue of free trade, and because of this, free trade would come and this was destroying unionized jobs, which it did. Bob White, who was then the president of the Canadian Auto Workers, which is Canada's largest private sector union, was amongst a myriad of other electoral leaders which openly and publicly criticized the NDP for avoiding labor issues and labor events during the campaigns in an attempt to move the party to the center and win votes from the political center. It was at this time where you saw various heads of unions say, maybe it's time we have a real labor party in Canada, though nothing ever came of that. The 1990s and early 2000s saw the rift between the NDP and labor grow wider. This time, many provinces saw NDP governments during these decades, and these governments were decidedly neoliberal in character. NDP governments in Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and British Columbia all introduced backdoor legislation against striking workers, and all introduced neoliberal austerity measures when they were in government. It became increasingly difficult to differentiate provincial NDP governments from governments of the traditional bourgeois parties. Perhaps one of the biggest blows to labor-NDP relations came with the Social Contract Act, which was introduced by the NDP government of Ontario. In 1990, the Ontario NDP formed the provincial government, the first time it had ever done so, and took office during the formidable recession of the early 1990s. The NDP immediately, on election night, Bob Rae, then Premier of Ontario, got on TV and had made this public address to dissuade fears that this was socialism come to Ontario. And it took like less than 3 hours from the time of the election to point out that the NDP in Ontario was going to be big business's biggest friend. So it took almost no time at all for them to sell out the movement and then continue to do so for 5 years. NDP initially decided that they were going to kill the deficit plaguing Ontario's financial situation, and this would drag Ontario out of deficit. And one of the major planks in fighting this deficit was the Social Contract Act, which was introduced in July of 1993. The Social Contract Act instituted a unilateral 3-year wage freeze on over 900,000 public employees, a wage rollback of 5%, which would cut $2 billion from the government payroll. And this 5% wage cut was the form of 12 days of unpaid work handed out to every single public servant in Ontario. The Social Contract legislated these reforms on previously negotiated collective agreements during the midterm of their collective agreements. So the NDP had opened up, negotiated, signed, and sealed agreements, and unilaterally changed their terms. The fact that this exceptionally anti-union piece of legislation was introduced by the NDP, where the theoretical allies of labor severely damaged the relationship between labor and the NDP. In fact, you had union leaders get up and say, like, look, we honestly could have expected this coming from the other two parties. Fine, you know, the Liberals or the Conservatives take $2 billion out of our hides. We would have expected that, but the Party of Labor is doing this. Give us a break. So because of the actions of the Ontario NDP, the Federal Party experienced a great backlash. Many unions have refused in the past 20 years to endorse the NDP in response to the Social Contract, which was introduced by a provincial government. And many trade unionists felt that the Social Contract was the ultimate betrayal of the labor movement and refused to donate time or money to the party or to vote for the party in subsequent elections at both federal and provincial levels. And this occurs today. Canadian trade unionists can hold a grudge for about 25 years, apparently, because if you still ask them, why won't you vote NDP? Social Contract, Social Contract, Social Contract. It has really killed the link between the party and the union movement. By the mid-2000s, union-party relations were fractured. Some unions, like the Canadian Union of Public Employees, the steel workers, and the energy and paper workers, remained allied with the NDP. The strategy of these unions is, well, they've done it before, they probably won't do it again. And then when the NDP does it again, they went, well, they probably won't do it again. And this goes on and on and on. Understanding why these unions continue to support the NDP is, I really haven't figured it out. Others have partnered with the Canadian Labour Congress in something called the Better Choices Campaign, a political issues campaign that's designed to keep all the parties of Canada talking about issues that have been identified as priorities for the labour movement. And these campaigns include both print and radio advertisements targeting union members both inside and outside the workplace. And other unions, namely the Public Service Alliance of Canada, which is a large public service union, and the Canadian Auto Workers, which is the largest private sector union, have engaged in a strategy of strategic voting. So the first attempt at strategic voting really came in the 1999 Ontario provincial election, and it was undertaken by the Ontario Election Network. which was an umbrella organization of trade unions and union councils. The major goal of the OEN was to defeat the Mike Harris Progressive Conservatives, and the OEN endorsed 26 candidates out of 103 ridings in the province. And the official announcements were given less than a week before Election Day. So this left almost no time for Labour to campaign for the candidates, nor to raise public awareness in the selected ridings about their preferred candidate. It was an abysmal failure for other reasons, which I can go into if you want during questions, but the OEN did fail, and the Mike Harris government was re-elected. Many union leaders immediately pointed out the campaign was poorly run, not enough money being spent on advertisements, and the campaign was not high profile enough. Then in 2003, the Ontario Election Network changed into something called the Working Families Coalition, which was a group of trade unions and union councils, essentially the same group in the OEN. They changed their name because they thought, you know, Working Families Coalition honestly sounded a lot more friendly and a lot nicer, and people might buy into it because, you know, they're families. And, they changed their name and kept doing the same thing. And they ran, this time they did run a province-wide campaign rather than just endorsing a handful of candidates. They endorsed a slate across the province. And the campaign never called for voters to vote for a specific party, but instead vote for anything but progressive conservatives. The 2003 campaign by the Working Families Coalition learned from the mistakes of the OEN. The WFC did not target specific ridings, instead it ran a province-wide campaign. The unions involved in the campaign, perhaps most importantly, spent a massive amount of money on public advertisement and also in direct financial contributions to candidates, most of whom were Liberals. The campaign was seemingly successful. Liberals were elected to a majority government in Ontario in 2003. Given the success of the O3 campaign, the WFC ran a strategic voting campaign in 2007 in Ontario. The Liberals were returned to power again. While these two campaigns saw the government election that Labour wanted, the public policy outcomes were generally a continuation of the previous Conservative government. The Dalton McGuinty Liberals in Ontario have frozen public sector wages, introduced backward legislation and legal strikes, refused to introduce anti-scab legislation, refused to introduce cards check legislation, and have demanded massive concessions from the auto workers in an exchange for a $1 billion bailout package for auto manufacturers. So the government that Labour encouraged to vote for has spent 8 years attacking the labour movement. The most recent strategic voting campaign by Canadian Labour was in the 2008 federal election. During this election, it was the express goal of the Canadian auto workers to prevent a Conservative majority government. The CAW urged members to vote for candidates which had the best chance of defeating Conservative candidates. The CAW campaign began 2 weeks after the election was called. CAW President Ken Walesa embarked on a week-long tour of cities home to high numbers of CAW members, all of which were in Ontario. And again, the CAW could not claim much success in 2008. The Conservatives won the election. The CAW only targeted 40 ridings out of the 308, and in only 7 of these 40 ridings did the non-Conservative candidate win. And in fact, in 9 further of the ridings, the 9 candidates who were incumbent non-Conservatives went down to hand at the feet of the Conservative candidate. So it was a spectacular failure. The strategy of strategic voting has failed on 2 levels. First, strategic voting has generally failed in all the campaigns they've tried. It was successful in Ontario in 2003 and 2007, but it failed federally in 1988, 2006, 2008, and 1999 in Ontario. Second, there is no evidence that the proposed outcome of strategic voting, the defeat of Conservative parties to the Liberal Party, would have a positive effect for organized labor. You know, so talk about these things and then wrap up. Union members in Canada do not often vote the way union leadership encourages them to do so. In fact, union members in Canada routinely vote more frequently for Conservative parties than they do for the NDP. This suggests that the first step in a successful strategic voting campaign must be to convince union members that voting for Conservative parties does not lie in members' best interests. The relative success of the 2003 and 2007 campaigns in Ontario compared to the failed campaigns show that a substantial expenditure of funds is required to run an advertising campaign for strategic voting. In many of the failed campaigns, no clear strategic candidate was identified on a riding-by-riding basis. In the literature on strategic voting, clearly shows that the ability to identify the candidate most likely to win a riding is paramount to the success of strategic voting. Should Canadian Labour proceed with the strategy of strategic voting, these issues must be addressed. Strategic voting campaigns must be run like full-fledged election campaigns with great expenditures of money for advertising. Candidates with the best strategic chance of winning must be identified, and some efforts must be made to educate union members as to why voting against conservative parties is in their best interest. I also argue that strategic voting suffers from an ideological deficit. One of the major planks in the strategy of strategic voting involves encouraging trade unionists to vote for the Liberal Party. As I previously discussed, the Liberal McGuinty government in Ontario, elected with the assistance of organized labour, has been exceptionally anti-labour. On a larger scale, the Liberal Party is a small-level Liberal Party that has openly embraced the logics of the free market and has highlighted the supremacy of business as both a policy maker in the Canadian political system, and has at both federal and provincial levels introduced a neoliberal labour market reforms when it has held power. Now, the Liberal Party of Canada has expanded the free trade agreements of the United States and NAFTA against the express interest of organized labour. The federal Liberals have also implemented wage controls, introduced back-to-work legislation and legal strikes, and on a number of occasions have expanded the essential service designation, preventing numerous public sector employees from striking. The Ontario Liberals have essentially maintained the neoliberal course of the progressive conservative government that has preceded it. The Liberals are a capitalist party which does not support the labour movement and has introduced very draconian anti-labour legislation. So I would argue that encouraging votes for the Liberal Party does not lie within the interest of the labour movement, and this is something that must be stopped. So then to, I suppose, when talking about elections and Labour's electoral strategy, I will now echo a much more famous question and try to answer what is to be done. For the past decade, the Canadian auto workers have been calling for the union to rebuild itself and embrace a broader working class politic. The CAW has advocated for more internal membership education in an attempt to turn rank and file members into union activists. This union argues they see politics as more holistic and inclusive than just electoral politics. They have encouraged activism within broader social movements. They encourage more organizing of the unorganized, and they suggest that the best place for political change is through collective bargaining. One of the major problems with Labour's electoral strategy has always been the inability of union leadership to convince rank and file members to vote for candidates that the unions have endorsed. These rank and file members remain disengaged from union politics and are also willing to vote for parties who do not fundamentally share their material interests. Strong union education and revitalization projects help energize the membership base of Canadian unions and rebuild the Canadian labour movement. This, in turn, can lead to the construction of a strong working-class political project by Canadian Labour. Whether Canadian Labour decides to continue with the strategy of strategic voting, which I have argued is incredibly misguided, or continue to support the NDP, which I would argue is equally as misguided, or embark on some new electoral project, the first strategy must be to get their own house in order, rebuild the rank and file of the labour movement into union activists, and to build a cohesive political unit that way. Because until you do that, any other strategy will ultimately fail, regardless of what the outcomes of that strategy are. So, that's all. I'm done.
Okay, so let's open the floor to questions.
I have a question, which I will ask the whole panel, so it's something that I think you will both upon. Just this theme of empty rhetoric and ideology came across in all of your talks there, and your case, this idea that you need to privatize state industries, it's empty rhetoric that strategic voting will somehow help the labor movement, and in your case, that this idea that it is good for developing countries not to protect their domestic industry and higher risk influx of foreign capital. Do you think this is a concerted effort of any kind to produce this rhetoric? It really seems to play into the hands of capital, doesn't achieve any of the things it promises. And if so, where do you think that is coming from? Is it an effort of capital as a whole, or certain elements within it, or right-wing media, or who would you say?
You mean the power of capital, or the producing discourse? Actually, this is one of the things I always try to not to do. Because in many discussions, especially recent discussions within Marxism, which is mostly based on state theory, and they discuss the role of the state, how will the Marxists define financialization, and for example, how will Marxists deal with the thing you say, capital's decreasing need for labor. So in this discussion, the most important mistake, I'm not sure if I'm wrong, correct me, I understood your question well. The most important mistake is you really exaggerate the power of capitalism. We define capitalism, and or we define media, or we define neoliberal ideology and hegemony as something penetrating, invading every place. And there is no space in this world for a struggle, or for there is no open space to do something. So the reason why I study the subjective experience of working classes rather than dealing with the structural dynamics of capitalism, one grab actually. How can we find non-capitalist spaces of struggle? For example, I don't agree with the discussion that capital, recognized capital has decreasing needs to labor. Actually, this is what maybe we should discuss this, because as Marx discussing capital, and after Marx, so many people discuss this fixed capital, variable capital, the falling price of profit, surplus value, and we all discuss this. Yeah, in historical evolution of capitalism, capital has much decreasing need to labor, but this also brings new contradictions to capital accumulation process, so open new spaces for struggle. So, if you are asking in these discussions in production of capitalism power, superficial, magical, penetrating, innovating, reproducing everything, if you are asking this, I don't agree with this general argument. I still think that there are open spaces of struggle. We can still create non-capitalist spaces of struggle, because these dynamics also bring new contradictions, which for capitalism as well. So the only point in my discussion, we should put a political intervention to the process rather than too much focusing on the theoretical discussions on the how capitalism is reproduced, how capitalism is how capital is internationalized, how capital has the power, hegemony over everything, and there is no space for breathing here.
What is happening is not an accident. There is a concerted effort. William Taft wrote in his book of the institutions of economic governance, IMF, World Bank, WTO. They are made, they are presented as neutral bodies. They are not. And who are those controlling these institutions? Now, we argue, or it is argued, that the battle is a battle of ideas. Unfortunately, for those of us on the left, every day, the intellectual war horses of the capitalist system, they think high. Of course, their arguments are not sound. They put old wine in new wine bottles, and we all fall for it. And if you look at the trend in scholarship, really, since about the mid-1980s, I was talking to somebody yesterday. I left the university in 1981, to be in 1987. Now, those who came after us since the late 1980s, many of those students have never heard of socialism. They have never heard of Marxism. So if I teach my graduate students about Marxist theory, they're looking at me as if I'm talking something strange. In fact, in Nigeria, there was that government of Babangida who was accusing radical lecturers of teaching what they were not paid to teach. Some of them were sacked. So you have universities that don't engage, even in the social sciences faculty, that don't engage in radical discourse. So it's not by accident. So many of those who embrace neoliberalism, they don't know any other thing apart from that. And when you confront them with that, it's like, oh, is that so? And that imposes on us, I mean, who do working class studies, who are interested in the social transformation, I mean. So then, and that's why, like you said, I mentioned it too, if we go back to the union, there is the need for the unions to be reorganized. If I was excited when you were talking about this, because if the unions engage in an old state involvement political struggles, their unions will be destroyed. I just put here, if the NDP or the CLC ask members or workers to vote for NDP and they refuse, it raises a fundamental question. How did the Congress arrive at the chance to support the NDP in the first instance? How are we sure that it's not just the leaders for their own personal benefit that will say, okay, well, don't worry, we'll mobilize for you? And if their members are not following them, it gives us a room to work with those members.
I think, well, talking about the empty rhetoric, I come from the CAW, you know, put the blame square on that sort of that many, well, the Canadian populace, especially the Canadian workers, have, you know, been on neoliberalism, put Lyman and Sanger. There were, listening to your talk, there were many, many eerie similarities between, I think, what's going on in Turkey and what's going on in Canada, in that the Canadian auto workers have no longer see, you know, the big three, GM, Ford, and Chrysler, as the enemy. The enemy is auto workers in other parts of the world. Now, the Canadian auto workers are fine, the United Auto Workers, because, you know, we have no problem with the United States, but Mexicans are taking our jobs, the Chinese are taking our jobs, Indians are taking our jobs. So it is not the reason this is put out strategic voting is, well, the argument is the Liberal Party is going to be good for Canadian manufacturers. Doesn't matter that they're anti-union. Doesn't matter that they try to break union on their own power. They're good for Canadian capital. And the Liberal Party is seen as the Canadian capitalist party, while the Conservatives are seen as an international capitalist party. And so we support the Liberals because they might hate us, but at least they like our bosses. And if they like our bosses, it's better than liking other people's bosses. And it's pretty sickening. I know I did my undergraduate at the same university that Hugo's at now, in St. Catharines, where there's a giant GM plant, and a couple days before we came here, there's this announcement, this massive new infrastructure in the auto manufacturing in St. Catharines, and this is great. The announcement was made by the president of General Motors, the federal industry minister, who's a conservative, who extracted more than $35 million through direct government involvement in free collective bargaining out of the auto workers, and the president of the Canadian auto workers. And then the three of them standing, literally arm in arm, hands over shoulders. You know, the boss, the head of the union, and the federal industry minister saying, this is fantastic, it's more job for Canadians. So I think this is part of the problem. The neoliberal logic is we see the enemy, whoever it is, you know, it's these people that are overseas that are taking our jobs. It's not the companies or the governments that are complicit in allowing this to happen.
I do have some comments. I come from a quite different background. I'm an economist, and I'm probably one of the few economists that is a little bit conservative. And I think some of the problems that you raise are interesting, but from a point of view of an economist, I see a little bit of a lack of the quantitative aspects. So, you know, for example, in Turkey, right? So Turkey is trying to get into the European Union. Well, I can tell you, more privatizations are coming your way. Whatever is not privatized now, the European Union will push for it. So how do you argue against it? You have to argue quantitatively, right? Are those sectors being privatized or that were privatized in the 90s showing that it's not working? Is it that people are paying higher prices? What is the consequence for labor? Okay. Are workers in a worse situation than they were in the 80s, conditional on the fact that the economy evolved in a particular way following a trend? How do you argue against privatization? Okay. I think we need to argue with the tools that those guys, you know, the IMF, World Bank, they are all a bunch of economists, right? They were my classmates. They are there using the quantitative stuff to make points, to make policy coming from the U.S. Because the U.S. controls these things. They are controlling an agenda. Yeah? And they can control it in a narrative. Who controls it? The U.S.? Fine. No problem. Yeah? And they are saying, show me that I'm not right. And you're not going to show it by making nice arguments, no matter how nice they are, if they are qualitative, because they say, I don't mind. And you go to Nigeria, and it's like, well, show me that the FDI is not good for your country. Yeah? Yes, sure, if it goes into the stock market, it's basically just people trying to make a quick buck. Yeah. But hey, we also support this small manufacturing, and we put the FDI in this and that, and show me that it doesn't work. Show me that you can do better. Yeah? And I think the quantitative arguments have a huge amount of weight, because the people moving the money are moving it because of just quantitative arguments. Yeah? They don't really have, you know, much of an ideology. The ideology is having no ideology. Right? The ideology is profit. The ideology is the money. And so how do you convince them otherwise with the number? Right? I mean, this is not working. I'm going to fight these arguments with their own argument. Because if you fight them with a different argument, they'll say, fine, it's just nationalism. Oh, you know. It's like, well, if the government has it, it's good. If the private sector has it, it's bad. Well, but that's just, you know. That's ideology.
For me, the fundamental question is this. Why must to privatize? Why must to privatize? In the case of Nigeria, is it because government or those entrepreneurs are not making money of our government? The financial sector, companies that were making profit were still privatized. So what is the point? And the real issue really for me, I don't look at the economist. These issues are issues of governance. What is best for the people?
Well,
because they are not even working. If between 1984 and 2010, 26 years, you keep rolling over about the same issues. In the case of the social welfare program, 2 years after it was introduced, both the IMF and the World Bank agreed that there were problems and were talking about adjustment for human face. I argued that this was not going to work. What the corporate globalization is essentially, they are promoting private corporate interests. Yeah. And why must we agree to that? It's because they are in a position of strength. After all, in Europe, electricity is controlled, Sweden for instance, is the government, not private individuals. And for most of developing countries, you need to get to a certain level comparable to where developed were at a similar point before you can answer. Look at South Africa. I thought the fundamental mistake was this. On the upper side, the blacks were disadvantaged. You need at least 10 years of free and compulsory education that will give you basic education, even up to the university level, to be able to get required skills to participate. So when you say equal employment opportunities, I can't have access if you don't have the basic education to compete. And these are issues of housing, healthcare. So what I'm saying is this. It's not about even on the basis of quantitative analysis or evidence. Privatization has not worked. In the case of Nigeria, for instance, the Nigerian state does not know the amount of crude that is treated in Nigeria every day. The government relies more on what Chevron shared the information provided. In three years, the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation has had 5 group managing directors. We were telling them at a point, why must you privatize refineries? If you cannot run them, you can hand over to those who can run for you. Let private individuals Neither liberalism can compete. Liberalization is that also. You don't have to deregulate, you can liberalize. Let private enterprises compete with government enterprises. You know?
But that has to come from the government, right? I mean, if you are a developing country and you have a nice resource, like oil in Nigeria, I'm going to go there, I'm going to buy these governments, essentially, by telling them, I'll invest, and you have plenty of money for whatever you want to do. You want to be as corrupt as you want. I don't mind.
These corrupt governments are also formed by the developed countries. I mean, if there's an African government coming up, they'll find a way of dealing with that. I mean, look at the problem with Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, you know. I mean, there are not many of them that are courageous enough to stand up to all the guys.
But the corruption
is not
obvious in the U.S.
Yeah, of course. Capitalism
is corruption.
Yeah, it's a question of care. Maybe the difference here is that people can be punished. I mean, if somebody will be punished to serve as Italian so that to make the state work. In Nigeria, the same person who stole money will be back in government before the investment. But here you can punish him, but then you can compensate him quietly.
Well, most of the corruption is every now and then they have a
show. I know, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
But it's not, but for a few ordinary
Americans, they don't think that the government is corrupt
or,
you
know,
the
African
American
corruption.
Well, because it's institutionalized, right?
Yeah, it is.
We have lobbies. Well,
yeah.
That is not corruption.
It is.
I pay you to do what I want, but it's not corruption.
It's
the last point about the Canadian example.
May I answer to this question of your question about privatization? Actually, in Turkey, most scholars in the field of economy analyze privatization in the way you ask. So there is a lot of literature about the effects of privatization, and I can show many data about this. But in my thesis, I try to analyze the result of privatization or other structural dynamics on the working class level. In economic terms, I'm telling you just a short story. I met a guy in Kırşehir, which is a city in central Anatolia. The factory was producing a petroleum oil refinery, and they were producing specifically plane tires, you know, plane tires. And he told me that he was producing 3 plane tires in a day, and one of them cost $70,000. It makes $210,000 in a day, the surplus he produced. And the government did not want to give this guy $100,000 for a month. So here, there are two positions. National economy is losing, but the workers are losing as well. In Turkey discussion, what manipulated? This is our national interest, European Union, requires these developments, economy will develop, but development does not guarantee employment. In Turkey, there was a period, 7% GDP rise and 10% increase in gap between rich and poor. So in this critical or neo-critical economic terms, I don't think it is good to discuss these cases.
The reactions of the workers are discussing are a problem of how they face that process.
Yeah, how they face these structural dynamics. So there is a need for a political intervention. And labor unions cannot do that. They are centralized, hierarchy, only political will of the workers. Maybe it's a good example of recent struggle of tobacco producers in Turkey, tekel workers. During this struggle, the ethnic division between Kurdish and Turkish workers eliminated, and union leaders tried to eliminate protests against privatization. But workers will, maybe this is too much Rosa Luxemburg idea, but workers will, rather than these centralized hierarchy structures, workers will, which is stemming from the pressure from this internationalization dynamics of capitalism, will provide some solution, I think, rather than this narrow economic productivity, efficiency, productivity discussions, I think. So,
And the last point on the Canadian system, I think, has a lot to do with basically show me what have you done for me lately, right? I mean, if the story goes into I vote for this party and then they reduce my salary. If you haven't shown me anything, why? Of course, the rank and file say, come on, no matter who I vote for, they're going to come up with something against me. So, yeah, I just do whatever I feel like, right? I try different things. And so, I think it has to be like consistency in terms of the discourse and what the worker sees. Otherwise, it shouldn't be a surprise that it's very random what people do. So, I think that aspects of, you know, showing what their, you know, sort of real wage has been in those periods of different governments probably tells you, you know, you are doing as bad with this government as with that government, so who cares? At the end, I just vote whatever I feel.